The number you have dialed is not in service. Please check the number and dial again. Or dial 611 for customer assistance. Message 53. PA03.
Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
And out in Signal Land, we have Alex.
You do indeed. Good evening.
Not coming from any place special tonight, Alex?
Oh, you don't think New York is special enough?
Well, you didn't say it.
This doesn't count?
Yeah, if you had mentioned that, I certainly would have said, wow, you're in New York. That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm in New York. It's amazing. I'm at home. It's incredible. I'm not traveling for a couple of weeks. Wow. I will be traveling again, over to the UK in a few weeks. But I'm back. It's nice to be back, and it's nice to be home for a little while.
Well, it's nice to have you here. So, welcome.
I appreciate that.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
You have kids, and I'm wondering, are the kids of today fascinated by the space program? Because, you know, for the first time in about 50 years, we're actually embarking on missions to the moon. And I remember when I was a kid the first time, wow, that was really fascinating. Now I'm a kid the second time, and it's really still fascinating to me. But I'm wondering, how is it with the younger generation? Or has it not come up at all?
Oh, it's come up quite a bit. And my oldest son is really quite fascinated with avionics and flight systems and planes and the entire aerospace industry. So, yeah, we watched this live. We watched the Artemis II launch. We were watching it again as they went around the moon, through the dark side of the moon, and lost communications for, you know, approximately 41 minutes. This whole thing is intensely fascinating for him, and I think it's one of the very few things about which we can remain to be proud as Americans. So I think that's pretty cool for kids to see.
Well, there's quite a bit to be proud of. I mean, not just that. I mean, I'm proud of, for instance, WBAI. Yeah, I said it. Proud of BAI because it's an American institution. Yeah, I said that too. And
I agree with that.
I hope people call and support the station and pledge on WBAI.org or give to WBAI.org. And keep the station going, absolutely. But this wasn't just a shameless plug for the station. I've been fascinated. Kyle and I have been watching the feeds pretty much nonstop since last week. The thing went up right before our show last week, and ever since then, it's been one amazing thing after another. But mostly, it's just the joy of the geekiness, you know, just people who are into the science and experiments and just spending a lot of time figuring things out. And you just you hear it in their voices, you see it in their faces as they're piloting this spacecraft, as people on the ground are making sure their every needs are taken care of. It's fascinating to watch. It's one of the really good things that I think we have done in this country. And I hope we do a lot more, because, you know, science is the future. Science is pretty much what it's all about. And it's nice to see a time where we're not at each other's throats, where we're not trying to figure out ways to harm people or to hurt the other side or whatever. This is pure exploration, and we need a lot more of it in a lot more fields. And I don't think you can ever have a better demonstration than what we've seen. But are there any highlights that you can remember from this last week? I mean, I'm looking at a story now about Artemis II astronauts making a long-distance phone call to the space station. They called the space station from the Artemis craft. One is about 25 miles above Earth. The other was about... what is it? 20, how far? 250,000 miles away. So quite a difference in distance. But they were able to make that connection, and it was just, you know, we're calling back when a long distance phone call meant something. Well, it still means something if you make it far enough.
Yeah, I mean it's pretty incredible, right? I think that there's a lot of overlap between this sense of curiosity, this childlike attitude towards the world and the universe, and how hackers approach the world as well. I mean, I think there's just so much in common in terms of the scientists at NASA and the hacker community, not just a love of science and a love of technology, but I think a love of knowledge and the love of sharing that knowledge as well, because that's what they're doing. We're not going into space and amassing knowledge and just hoarding it. NASA's doing what hackers do. They acquire this knowledge and they spread it around the world. They shout it from the rooftops. They let everybody learn from it. And I think that that's pretty cool in terms of the overlap of our two cultures. But in terms of the highlights, I mean, I got to say, getting the images back was pretty amazing.
Wow.
I think a lot of people with new background or desktop images on their machines, you know, seeing the Earth set was pretty amazing. Seeing that eclipse was incredible. Just being up in space and knowing that humans were farther away from Earth than they ever have been, and we set a record in going around the moon, and now they're on their way back, hopefully safely. It's pretty goddamn cool.
And hearing them struggling with things like their USB-C connector isn't working for some reason, it just is so familiar, except they're way out there in space dealing with these things. But it's somehow comforting, you know, to see the four of them interacting. And, you know, I have to say, as a witness to the first time this happened, where people were sent up there, it feels like they've changed as far as who they are as human beings. It's not just a bunch of white guys with Midwestern accents being sent up to space and coming back down and saying the same things. You know, this is a diverse group of people. You saw them get really emotional when they were naming a crater after the late wife of one of the astronauts. I never saw four people hug in space before. Now, if this were Star Trek, all the Trekkies would be saying, oh, this is too woke, you got to get it off the air immediately. Not all the Trekkies, obviously, but, you know, the conservative ones. And here, you know, this is real life. People have changed. People have gotten a little bit more aware of other people. I'd like to think that, anyway. I know there's certainly a lot that we have to fix and mend, because in the background of all this, of course, you have threats to take out entire civilizations and things like that, and you just wonder, are these guys going to, you know, make a left turn and head to Mars instead of coming back to Earth? But it's just it's one of these magical moments that basically is going to last up until Friday when they splash down. I'm just glad that you know, we're all around to see it and hopefully appreciate it. If you have an interest in this kind of a thing, it's not too late. You can just turn on NASA TV. If you don't get NASA TV, they have several channels on YouTube without commercials. Google does not interrupt them with commercials. And you can simply watch what's going on inside the spacecraft or see a picture from the outside of what it looks like. It's, you know, what they call slow TV, I guess. Not much is going on, and then all of a sudden, a lot is going on. So it's really, it's an incredible thing. Young and old, I think we can all appreciate that. And people who are into technology and science and hacking and things like that, yeah, especially. Kyle, I know you've been interested in this as well.
Yeah, what can I say? That hasn't been said. Those are great observations, and I'm sure a lot of people are really spellbound by it. I think it is good. It's a very positive development, all kinds of wonderful discovery, and you do certainly appreciate the simple things of day-to-day life when so much of your environment changes and you're in a vehicle doing this kind of science and exploration. So, yeah, it's I think for me, I have a difficult time. I think there's some sadness too because you contrast it, but I don't want to, you know, dwell. So yeah, sure, it's super happy, and we're all the better for it. And I just hope that the things that other than the sort of shot in the arm and all that, like good feeling and sort of voyeurism we get of like watching this story unfold. And being there along for the ride sort of virtually, is that the benefits of this materialize for humans on Earth faster than half a lifetime, maybe several lifetimes, because I think that's a lot of, you know, alongside the sheer accomplishment and record setting and all of that, that's the other aspect of this, is that humanity will benefit, and I'm sure already has, from a lot of the things that it takes to get to do this kind of thing. We learn and develop things and create industry and all of that, but I'm really, really hopeful that our collective investment in the story of it now, as perhaps you might call it a distraction, that investment pays and yields returns for people.
Well, if all goes well, in 2 years, actual human beings will be walking on the moon again. That will be incredible. First step towards a permanent base, and also first steps towards going further than the moon. To me, that is the pinnacle. That is what it's all about, is expanding, learning, exploring. And if you can't do that, you know, you're spinning your tires, I think. Go ahead, Alex.
One of the things that I think is really fascinating to think about from the perspective of technology and the hacker culture, too, is you think about the computation power of Artemis. Yeah, this week, today, right now, right? Artemis right now is flying with more processing power inside of it, right, than the entire shuttle program had in the ground the last time we went around the last time we went towards the moon, right? Yet it's still riding on the basis of the same ancient equations, right? It's the same physics. It's the same equations that we're using. It's just, you know, we're talking about thrust. We're talking about gravity. And there's this kind of tiny corridor between them where Artemis is going to fly. But the technology has advanced so much, but yet, you know, there's still this ancient component to it that is a natural law of the universe that's allowing us to do this. I think there's something incredibly cool about that.
Oh, absolutely. It's universal. It's something that knows no boundaries, and in all likelihood applies everywhere, but we're not sure about that because we haven't explored everywhere. There might be all kinds of different rules in different parts of the universe. This is how we expand our knowledge base. This is how we get access to new forms of technology. So much did come out of the space program previously, satellite technology of all sorts. Go ahead, Alex.
You know, you've been around for a little while, Manuel. You remember historical things, right? Do you remember an incident in the 80s? I think it was like the late 80s, where the CCC, the Chaos Computer Club, had hacked into NASA's like VMS systems. Do you remember something like that?
I remember lots of people doing that, but sure, why not? They probably did that as well. Yeah, I got into in my heyday. I got into statute of limitations is long gone, but I got in. Plus, I was also charged for it. I was looking at plans for the space station and NASA, which was a different space station than what they built. So there was no space station at the time I was reading this, and it was just kind of incredible. I wish I had kept it. Would have been pretty fascinating.
You should have.
But what about breaking into NASA back in the 80s?
Yeah, well, it was the CCC. It was the Chaos Computer Club that did it, and it was something called the SPAN Network. I think it was like the Space Physics Action Network or something like that. But it was a bunch of VMS systems strung together. But what I thought was cool about that was that rather than trashing the systems or releasing the information or something like that, like the CCC actually told NASA about this and alerted them to it. And it was kind of that same spirit of sharing knowledge and helping them to further secure their systems, but apparently not secure enough.
Well, I mean, I don't think they've been compromised too much recently. But the thing is, you know, we're all curious. We're all probing things and learning from our mistakes and learning from progress. And I hope this is an example of that. Anyway, again, encourage people to pay attention to see what's going on and hopefully be a part of exploration in the future, which is so much better than destruction. Okay, moving on. First of all, some scheduling notes. We do not have overtime tonight. Overtime is our podcast version of the show that follows 8 o'clock on YouTube. But we're short-staffed tonight, so we're going to skip that. That'll be back next week, and, of course, this show will be back next week. So we're just going to do the hour here on WBAI, and we're going to continue to encourage people to support the radio station as we are in our fund drive. We're about a quarter of the way through our goal for the month, which works out because it's, April 7th? So, that's almost exactly a quarter of the way through. So let's keep up that pace, and, hopefully we'll make the goal. That's the important thing. And if we make the goal, then we live another day, so we continue to operate a radio station in the middle of New York with no commercials. Since 1960, we've been doing this. All right, what else has been going on in the world of technology and online antics? Oh, boy, do I want to read this story? It's a new controversial online game. This is unbelievable. It's sweeping through classrooms across the U.S. It's called Five Nights at Epstein's. as in Jeffrey Epstein. Oh, my God. Players pretend to be sexual assault victims trapped on the convicted sex offender's infamous island. And in order to win, they have to dodge Epstein for five nights to avoid being abused by him. Oh, my God. Who comes up with it? The rapid popularity of the game has left many parents and school administrators deeply concerned. Well, who wouldn't be deeply concerned by this? It's according to this story from NPR, it's difficult to pinpoint exactly where the game originated, but it emerged in the last few months as the Justice Department began slowly releasing more of the Epstein files. It's a spin-off of a more innocuous game called Five Nights at Freddy's. And that actually inspired another iteration of a game called Five Nights at Diddy's, which became popular around the time of the Sean Combs trial in the last couple of years. And now we're seeing the Epstein-themed iteration of it. I don't want to go into details to what goes on in this game, but basically kids are playing this on their school Chromebooks or their school networks, trying to bypass places where it's been blocked. So across the top social media platforms, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, it's quite easy to search for. This makes you think about how the kids are viewing what's going on in the world. And again, Alex, turning to you as a parent, must give you cause for concern.
This is crazy. I mean, both my kids. Actually, I have one of them going through the Five Nights at Freddy's craze right now, but my older one did about 5 years ago. So the age that kids get into what's called FNAF, or Five Nights at Freddy's is probably like around 8 or 9 years old. That's when they really start playing it. It's kind of a bizarre game. It's creepy to begin with, to be honest with you. It's a horror game kids.
Is this Freddy Krueger?
No, it's not Freddy Krueger. I don't know exactly who Freddy that's a very good question. I think it's the name of the pizzeria. So the whole concept of the game is that you're like this night shift security guard who's trying to survive five nights in a haunted kids' pizzeria where these murderous animatronic robots and mascots stalk you via certain security cameras. It's a bizarre game. There's all these jump scares that happen. It's actually pretty frightening. But the kids love it, and they love to be scared. I think it's kind of awful and horrible, though, to hear that, you know, Five Nights at Epstein's is something. I mean, look, it's got to be funny. Maybe the older kids.
Well, that's more scary, I guess, than the murderous robots or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could see, you know, Five Nights at Epstein's, you know, being at Epstein Island, and then you have some kind of sequel to it where you're at his Manhattan townhouse, and then you have another sequel where you're down in Palm Beach and you're trying to escape Florida or something. I mean,
I'm more concerned about the copyright issues. I'm kidding.
That's hilarious.
Somebody out there is concerned about that. You know, you ripped us off with the Epstein version of this.
Yeah, but what's really kind of sad about this? So you have this fictional horror world, but now it's being wrapped and almost fictionalized and parodied in this real world of abuse. Right. So it turns this like jump scare franchise about a haunted pizzeria into this really grim kind of tale about what was really real sex trafficking and an operation that, you know, was protected by certain institutions and people around the world and has real victims. And so in that sense, I think it's particularly irreverent to make light of it in that way. But
yeah, it's a whole CSI syndrome, you know, where it's basically, you know, something that happened in the news 6 months ago, and now you're seeing it play out in fiction. Same thing with video games.
No. Yeah. I'm wondering who made this. I mean, this is probably like some kind of Roblox riff on it or something like that would be my guess. Does it say where and who and how it's accessed?
I don't have that information, but curious, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
we can interview the person with, you know, all kinds of voice masking and things like that. But, yeah, that's just something to be aware of if you're a parent. That might be going on. Well, okay, let's move towards AI if we're going to really try to scare ourselves. Now, Microsoft apparently is aware that you should not be trusting Copilot. Remember we talked about last week, Alex, with the typing? You know how loud that is over the air?
Sorry about that.
Incredibly loud. Okay.
Trying to multitask here. Yes, yep.
Let's try and focus. Okay, despite the last update taking place in late 2025, the document for Copilot for Individuals recently attracted new attention from people on the net. It includes this gem: Copilot is for entertainment purposes only. It can make mistakes, and it may not work as intended. Don't rely on Copilot for important advice. Use Copilot at your own risk. Not exactly a ringing endorsement of their own product there, but one that I think is fairly accurate. Now, this story comes from the Register, and regular readers there would not be shocked by that warning Copilot gets things wrong and should not be relied on. The company itself has long acknowledged the assistant's limitations. During the London leg of its AI tour, for example, every demonstration of Copilot wizardry came with a warning that the tool could not be fully trusted and that human verification was required. The same applies to any other AI assistant. They can be useful, but their output still needs checking, particularly on anything consequential, like medical advice or an investment plan. A commenter on Hacker News pointed out, Anthropic does a somewhat similar thing. If you visit their terms of service, the one for Max/Pro plans from a European IP address, They replace one section with this, non-commercial use only. You agree not to use our services for any commercial or business purposes, and we and our providers have no liability to you for any loss of profit, loss of business, business interruption, or loss of business opportunity. The commenter added, it's funny that a plan called Pro cannot be used professionally. As for co-pilot's terms of use, they may not be new, but the attention is useful for two reasons. It is a reminder to read the text users so often click through, and it underlines that chatbots such as Copilot are neither companions nor dependable sources of advice. Instead, they are error-prone tools that can be helpful one moment and confidently wrong the next. Some in the tech industry may market AI assistants as though they put a genius in every laptop, but Microsoft's own warning is rather less grand. It can make mistakes, and it may not work as intended. I'm wondering if this is the way out of the AI mess, simply acknowledging that it's not perfect, that it's going to get things wrong a lot, and that it's entertaining and fun and might even be helpful sometimes, but we should never, ever, ever rely on it as the final word. I think if we just agree to do that, no matter how good it gets, that at least saves us from, the AI apocalypse that we're all dreading. Any thoughts?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about this. This is, I think, a really interesting topic. But I think ultimately what our listeners really need to understand about these LLMs and these AI systems in general is that they're non-deterministic, meaning that you can get different outputs depending upon the input that you put in, or you get different outputs for the same input as well. So, I mean, that becomes a problem, right? So if you think about Copilot, right, under the hood, Copilot is kind of like Clippy, but with a law degree, with a physics degree, et cetera, right? It's like kind of Clippy on these quantum dice. So if you ask it the same question twice and you get three different answers, how are you supposed to build some kind of policy off of that? How are you supposed to build anything off of that? How is that a solid foundation for anything? But so if you understand that AI systems are going to provide different answers at any particular time, understanding that they are non-deterministic is the technical term for it, that's really, really important because, you know, non-deterministic output, when it's plugged into deterministic compliance rules or systems, is how you have to end up explaining to somebody like a regulator or your boss or having a conversation with a lawyer or your general counsel that, oh, you know, the model did it, you know, while you're sitting in some kind of HR hot water. So I think we're right not to trust these systems with everything. I think their rules and their warnings are accurate, but I think it's also got to be reflected in their marketing materials.
Well,
not just the fine print.
Do you think Microsoft is doing the right thing here by telling people not to trust Copilot?
Yeah, I think they are. I think everybody should not trust their AI systems. And the one thing that AI systems do not have that human beings do have, and which I think will never be replaced entirely because it's empirically based and experience based, and that's judgment. You know, they don't exercise great judgment. They may be able to put together an argument. They may be able to put together a summary. They may be able to synthesize information much faster than we can, in much the same way that when computers first became, you know, really accessible to the public, we were able to do so many more things with them than we could without them,
mm-hmm.
Namely, like, count things really fast, we put things in memory, all these things, you know, that we're going to change the world and change the universe. I think that's how we have to think of AI systems now as well, is that they are these helpers. They help us automate and do these mundane tasks, but they should never be used to substitute for human judgment. I mean, I use AI systems all the time. I use Claude Code a lot, but I always have to check it. You always have to verify the sources. Mm-hmm. It gets things wrong sometimes, and it exercises particularly poor judgment on hard cases where there's gray areas, where one thing could go one way and one could go the other way. And you can iterate and you can go back and forth with it and say, well, have you thought about this? What if we did it this way? And then you get some other non-deterministic answer. So you really can't trust the output no matter what. You always have to trust your own judgment.
And when it goes down a wrong path, it's very hard to get back from that wrong path. If it says something as a fact and you say, well, no, that's not true, it'll keep going back to that fact and basically almost doubling down. The thing to remember with AI, it doesn't care. It's incapable of caring, whereas a human being cares. At least, you know, you'd like a human being to care. But the other thing to remember is that humans certainly aren't infallible either. You say if you ask AI a question three times or three instances of AI the same question, you'll get three different answers. Same thing with humans. You'll get three different answers. Humans will be wrong as well. We seem to think that because AI is fast and because it can say a lot, that it's always right. And it just can be wrong a lot faster. And that's something I think we need to remember. Here's another story that I thought was kind of interesting. This is involving Target. They are saying that if their AI shopping agent makes an expensive mistake, you're the one that's going to be on the hook for it. Now, big box chains have probably embraced artificial intelligence. Don't expect them to help when their AI assistants charge your card for hallucinated garbage. Yes, that trend in which retail giants force their AI initiatives on consumers while distancing themselves from its failures is growing. And while that attitude certainly isn't unique to big box stores, it's increasingly becoming their default setting, revealing the ridiculous double standard that's baked into the AI boom. This article coming from Futurism.com, Target is the latest to jump on the bandwagon. According to Business Insider, the Minnesota-based retail operation or corporation recently updated its terms and conditions to make it clear that customers, not the company, would be responsible for the failures and hallucinations of its upcoming AI shopping assistant. That virtual buddy, which runs on Google's Gemini, is supposed to help online shoppers finish Target runs on their users' behalf. Under the new terms, if a customer uses the Gemini agent to do their shopping for them, any transaction performed by the AI would be considered transactions authorized by you, which translates to any mistake by the AI agent, whether it buys the wrong item entirely or a super expensive version of the right one without your consent, that will come out of your pocket. Now, it's without your consent, that bugs me because, you know, they're saying here that they consider transactions to be authorized by you. But if you're not giving your consent, how can you make that assumption? Well, the new terms state you are responsible for reviewing activity performed by your agentic commerce agent. Yes, that's what it's called. And for promptly notifying the agentic commerce agent and Target of any activity you believe is unauthorized or outside the scope of permissions you approve. So you have to be on top of this, watching every move. If that weren't enough proof that Target doesn't stand by its product, it gets more explicit. Target does not purport to guarantee that an agentic commerce agent will act exactly as you intend in all circumstances. You should review orders, account activity, and settings regularly. And it doesn't sound unreasonable. Yeah, you should pay attention. You should see what is being done on your behalf. But, you know, it could get kind of difficult if it's a slight deviation from something that you want or it's giving you the wrong product and you were supposed to catch that, but, you know, it was a mistake that the AI made and not you, so you had no idea it was going to make that kind of mistake. I could see times where you would feel like you're being victimized. Any thoughts on this?
It feels like they're offloading a lot of the liability onto the consumers.
Yeah.
That's all it is. I mean, that's my takeaway, is that they gain some sort of profit or reduction in their overhead, whatever. Their business runs better by using this, by implementing this stuff, and conditioning us to use it in our consumption of their products. And any sort of problem, this is going to pave or smooth the way for absconding themselves of any kind of responsibility for what is essentially something that is going to make the processes of their business easier for them to do without, I guess, maybe hiring people to answer phones or answer questions or chat live while someone's trying to pick something out. But whatever it is, it just, I'm so skeptical that this is worth the risk to accept. I mean, I would think very carefully about the kinds of things that they're kind of putting in your responsibility, like offloading onto the consumer.
Well, it's interesting that you say, you know, hiring people to help out. Imagine that. Imagine if they had to do that. These big companies that used to hire people to help you, replace them with AI, and now they're saying AI is not people. You know, it's not something that you can rely on. Well, okay, bring back the people then. I think that sounds like a good idea. It's basically, you know, they're trying to cover their asses. There's no question about that.
Well, and I think they think that we'll accept it because it's this sort of temporary thing, because off in the future we're going to have this general intelligence that doesn't make any of these mistakes, and they'll just upgrade whatever they're bolting onto their commerce sites now to that, and we won't have these problems then. And I don't know, it just sounds like geoengineering out of man-made problems, you know, or I don't know. I just, I can't buy that this is all for the benefit of the consumer, and that this is why we should be thankful for these brand overlords for implementing this fancy technology. I got news for you, people. High tech, new technologies, they're not going to be brought to you necessarily as a gift from these companies. They'll sell you their version of it. But ideas, innovation, it is probably not something that is commodified. It's something that you might be better suited at doing than a lot of these firms. It boggles my mind that like people can adopt free services and do these sorts of embrace these things that are essentially magic to them, and think of it as like the pinnacle, like the end all of high technology. I think that's really selling this era short. There's so much more you can do than what pops out of a vending machine.
Well, Target is joining other retail giants like Walmart in rolling out AI shopping agents that it openly distrusts, which is pretty fascinating when you think about that. Walmart, which recently outraged consumers with AI-powered price gouging, also updated its terms of use to cover for mistakes made by its AI shopping assistant. Who can name Walmart's AI shopping assistant? Anyone? No, Kyle? I don't know. I have it in front of me, but I didn't know before now.
Wait, is it Wally?
No. Although that would have been a good name.
That would have been a good one.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't use that. No, it's Sparky. It's Sparky. Yeah.
Sparky. Do you remember Sparky was the name of the Spark station at Stony Brook that everybody used to hack back in the day?
Well, I don't think Walmart knew that.
Well,
I will say that this is an area of interest. I mean, the ability for these things to find different products, to go through what's available at different e-commerce sites, I've played around with it. I think a lot of people are realizing that this could be very, very helpful, but not everyone is the same, and not all of them are equal. And you have to understand that if you're using the implementation of it from a particular entity, it may be getting very little in the way of resources, and may be heavily weighted towards recommending and pushing certain products and certain things on you that you might not be aware of other deals or competitors or other ways of doing something, and it'll be biased in favor of the firm that's implementing it. But if you use what I think of as search engines, but some of these assistants to speak to them naturally and ask them questions about products and things, and to sort of augment your insight into the marketplace and your ability to shop, I think there can be huge benefits to that, and it can be fun to play with. There was an instance I was installing something that had dip switches, like an electronic device, a controller for charging and battery setup. So anyway, it was telling me about all of them, and it was asking me a little bit about the model that I got, because I was upgrading it to a higher power rating, but it in the process, it was so confidently telling me that, yes, these have to be off, and, you know, all eight of these dip switches have to be off, and then in parentheses it put the position of the dip switch, and it said up, but up was on. I was looking at the manual, like the paper manual that I had, and I'm looking at a diagram, clearly up is on. So if I had so it was contradicting itself in the same list of instructions. I didn't even bother trying to correct it.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of stuff where you have to know a little bit more about the scenario. You can, it's fine, you know, you can, you know, load it with schematic or information like facts and help you go through things, but it's not, unless you're in control of it, parsing things, you know, step by step and stuff, well, you're really leaving it to make all kinds of these mistakes unattended. So you shouldn't be surprised.
You have to take the high road sometimes.
Absolutely.
Because it's going, like I said before, it's going to get things wrong and it's going to double down and keep getting it wrong. And you can try and correct it as many times as you want, but it's still going to keep assuming something that's not actually true, that you know isn't true. But there's just no way to convince AI.
That's exactly why I didn't even engage, because I had heard accounts of you trying to correct something, you know, that you noticed that was a mistake to see if it would atone and correct its own answer instead of defending it. I didn't want to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew, okay, this is wrong. I know I got what I needed out of this as far as steps, things to look out for, other tips that passed what I felt like was a logical, reasonable things, little reminders that I might not have been thinking about. But take it for a grain of salt, absolutely.
Have you had a situation where you're online trying to fix a problem with something that you subscribe to or have bought, and you're talking to the company, and you know you're talking to AI, and, you know, you're making some progress, and maybe it even solves your problem, but sometimes it doesn't, and then you wind up talking to a person. You ask to be transferred to a person, and now you're talking to what was her name again? You were talking to somebody. It was the exact same name, Kayla or Shayna or...
Oh, Kyla.
Kyla, that's
no,
right.
Don't knock Kyla. Kyla
no,
was very helpful.
I've talked to Kyla with a totally different company, and I just wonder, why do we keep getting the same names? But, yeah, so we're talking to this alleged human, and now we're talking to somebody who is able to solve our problem on a human level. But how do we know? How do we know we're not talking to another AI? How do we know the first AI wasn't just a fast-typing human? There's no way to know. There's no way to really know who or what you're talking to. It's both maddening and hilarious at the same time. Alex, go ahead.
Well, I think that's where this whole notion of proof of humanity comes into play, and we need a naming system for these agentic helpers as well, so that they can be perhaps discovered or contacted or something like that. That there's lots of standards and various things being thought of at the moment with respect to the discovery and interaction of these agents amongst each other. But to go back to this issue of trusting them, and in particular with Target and Walmart and all these other companies that are distrustful of their own agents helping people shopping, I mean, I think it goes back to the what we were talking about before. It seems like Target and Walmart and all these other big retailers actually do understand what's happening under the hood with respect to these AI systems and the fact that they are non-deterministic, and that it might recommend you to buy a Rolex, or it might recommend that you watch, or it might recommend that you buy a Vacheron or something like that, depending upon how you ask it or the particular time of day on which you ask it. But the non-deterministic nature of this, I think, is really interesting. It seems like they understand it. But to my mind, I think there's something really exquisitely perfidious about a company and an AI system that begs you to trust it and use it, and then immediately hides behind some kind of legal disclaimer when you're unhappy with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, come on. You have to stand behind your product. Either you know it's fit for purpose or don't offer it at all.
Well,
speaking of
standing behind your own product, May 20th, Amazon will stop supporting any of its Kindle devices that were released in 2012 or earlier. That means that these devices, even if they're perfectly functional, won't be able to connect to the Kindle store to download new ebooks. Amazon says affected devices include the first and second generation Kindles, the Kindle DX and DX Graphite, the Kindle Keyboard, the Kindle 4, the Kindle Touch, the Kindle 5, and the first generation Kindle Paperwhite. According to The Verge, Kindle Fire devices will also be affected on the ebook front, though other apps will still work on the device. Yeah, so this is outrageous. Yet another example of how these companies just expect you to buy it again. Other recent examples of companies doing this, Spotify ending support for its car thing in 2024, Google discontinuing its older Nest thermostats last year, that affected me. In February, Netflix ended support for nearly 87 million older devices. I've had that happen in the past. You know, they still work. They still do everything they're supposed to do. The company that sold them to you, they still exist. They're still selling the service. They just don't want to sell it to you anymore. They don't want you to benefit from it. But you've already paid for it. It's not like you're paying a monthly subscription and they're saying, oh, the subscription fee is going up or we're discontinuing that subscription. No, you've bought the device, and the understanding of buying the device means you will have access to this. If they're going to change the rules, they need to provide you with a new device to replace the one that they're deciding is no longer worth it. I mean, what if you went down to Amazon and you tore down their building and said, this building is old. It's no good anymore. You need to build a new one. They wouldn't like that, would they? Now, you know, consumers don't like to be robbed, and this is robbery. This is absolute robbery. Yeah, you can laugh at somebody who has a Kindle that's 14 years old, but, you know, I actually think somebody who has a 14-year-old Kindle is worthy of respect, just like people who have old phones, old computers, old bits of technology. They've kept them running, and they know what they're doing, and they should be allowed to continue to run their particular hardware or software. These companies should not be interfering and saying, you know, you can do it better, and we're going to force you to buy it again. That is just completely wrong, and I hope there's some kind of reaction against this. Even though I don't own a Kindle that old, it's getting close, and this kind of thing just really annoys me. Kyle?
Oh, I just would point out, I agree, Ben, my attitude is that it ought to be illegal to have these kinds of business practices with products that are themselves not defective, but rather becoming an end of life as far as the support from the manufacturer. I think it should be illegal unless you provide some form of off-ramp, like what you're talking about, rebate or some sort of buyback or replacement options that are really competitive and don't make the consumer feel like they've lost value or lost capability from what they originally purchased, or some other combination. I think there should be recourse for sourcing parts in the aftermarket when the manufacturer stops supporting them, or up to and including schematics or specifications for things, so that if people wanted to have a large purchase independently for perhaps battery packs for things that need replacements, etc. Like, that stuff is basically the heart of a lot of right to repair legislation that is catching on in this country. And I think that, yeah, if you like your device, you don't want to make it a source of waste immediately, you should have the ability to repair it. You should have options for at least some phased option to take ownership of it when there's no one else to help you with that support.
I mean, look how they have us trained. You know, we all have phones in our pockets now, but that's not good enough. You know, you pay hundreds of dollars, sometimes over $1,000 for these phones. You'd think that would be enough. You know, when I grew up, we had a phone. You know, the phone was there. It was dependable. It rang, you picked it up, you talked. Yeah, it was simple, but it worked. And, you know, it worked forever. Here we have something so much more advanced. You would expect it to last a while. But no, 5 years max, and then your phone is considered obsolete. You have to buy it again. You have to buy another one or trade it in and, you know, pay a few hundred dollars more. But you're in this cycle where you just have to keep buying and buying and buying and paying the same companies. And, you know, at some point, why can't you be happy with what you have and you know, be satisfied that this phone is going to work this year, next year, for the next 10 years? But no, we can't even wrap our heads around that. A phone that lasts 10 years, my God, what kind of dinosaur are you? Well, you know, maybe the newest app isn't always what you need. Maybe you want the basics. Maybe you want to just be able to make phone calls or text or play certain video games or whatever. It's up to you, not up to them. They have us trained so well that it's abnormal to think otherwise, that you have to buy a new phone every 5 years. It's really ridiculous. Alex.
You know, what really gets me about this is, if you think about the dirtiest part of the tech life cycle, it's not necessarily the power that you're drawing from the grid to run these devices. Think about it in these terms, right? The environmental impact here comes from the perfectly good hardware that these companies are pushing off a cliff in the name of the support life cycle. And then these very same companies then dare to run some kind of audacious Earth Day campaign on the way down. Uh-huh. I mean, that's what's really unbelievable to me. This is where I think we need to call them out. It's like, let's wait for Earth Day to bring up the right to repair next time. I think those two are perfect complements of each other.
Yeah, and I mean, we also should just educate ourselves. We should have work parties. We should have repair parties. Like, all these kinds of things should be something that we acculture ourselves to step up to the level of engineering that is all around us and not be so disposable.
Yeah, absolutely. We're out of time, unfortunately.
Oh, I was going to talk about they found out who started Bitcoin.
Oh, can we wait till next week?
Oh, you don't want to talk about crypto?
Let's do this. You know, we'll remember next week. Don't worry about it. OTH at 2600.com is our email address. Please write to us. Support WBAI. Give to WBAI.org. Become a BAI buddy. Keep 99.5 FM alive in New York City. This is Emmanuel for Off the Hook. We will see you next week. Keep looking to the skies and keep watching the astronauts. Good night.